Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me this morning for the first half hour is Grant Carden, USU Extension Soil Specialist, and we're going to talk about cover crops. So if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can also email us at upraccess@gmail.com, or you can also tweet us your question at #AUGarden. Grant, thanks for coming back in.
Great to be here.
This idea of doing a cover crop has always been kind of fascinating to me, because once you get the cover crop in, all you've got to do is till it in once it's planted, and you're incorporating all of this wonderful organic matter that sometimes you make a lot of people haul leaves onto the garden. They bring manure into the garden. So this is kind of known as a green manure.
It's a green manure. Yeah, that's right. And it gives you the added advantage of the fact that the roots zone of the crop is exploring, you know, the soil profile pretty thoroughly and depositing root material down below ground even better than you can even mix it in. So the root system itself is going to explore a whole lot, and then you're leaving that in place, and it's decaying in place, and it's providing all kinds of organic matter as well as opening channels for air and water movement in the soil. So
can you plant this while you've already got vegetables in the ground? So if you've got like my 4 to 5 foot walkways between my corn, I thought, well, maybe I could get this started, but the corn's up pretty high and it's kind of shady
right now, but there are some that'll survive. You know, some of the grass crops and things that are more shade tolerant, you can maybe plant in between as walkways. And a lot of people will plant a grassed walkway between various places in their garden, and that actually does then provide the organic matter, stabilizes the soil, helps prevent against compaction while it's in place. And then when you, like you said, kill it back and till it in and things like that, it'll decay and then redeposit all that material there. So it's a good opportunity. Or you can rotate, you know, use part of your garden one year for active growing of your fruits and vegetables, and then half of it's in cover crop for the year, and then you can switch it back and forth like that. So you're not leaving anything bare, and you're breaking disease cycles and other things which you might build up over time growing your garden in the same place year after year. So
it's kind of like the Jewish tradition of having a jubilee year where you let the ground lie fallow, except in this case you're not growing anything in it other than something to help the soil to recover a little
right,
bit.
Right. It's a rest and replenishment kind of an approach to the use of your soil. So
what is the end result supposed to be? Are you going to see a difference after 1 year, or is this something that you should be doing every year?
Well, certainly it's a long-term benefit, but you will see improvement year to year. One of the things that we try to stress when we're talking about organic matter in soils is that, number one, our environment doesn't support a lot of native plant growth, and so we don't have a lot of organic matter to start with. And it's really important to soil structure. And if we're not replenishing it each year or building it each year, then the microbes that are there that are breaking that stuff down naturally are going to continue to decrease the levels over time. And so we're losing all the things that, if we're not replenishing it, that build soil structure, that provide water retention and nutrient retention sites in the soil, and that are slow release mechanisms for stored nutrients in the soil. As they decompose, they'll release those nutrients over time. And it's, you know, you get a lot of benefits from that organic matter. If we're not replenishing it, it's decreasing year after year. So you will see annual improvement if you manage it correctly.
So what kind of improvement would you see if you have a sandy soil?
You'll see improvements in water retention and nutrient retention in particular in sandy soils, not as much in the structure area that we would say, you know, if it interacts with the clay particles and builds the clod, not the clods, but the peds and soil granules in there. But you'll definitely see in a sand improvement in water retention and nutrient retention in particular. And that's a really important aspect to the function of those. We have a lot of coarse soils on the benches and other places around the valleys and in Utah.
I mean, all those rocks that I hauled off for 10 years on my parents' garden.
Yeah. Yeah, we sit on gravel beds, pretty completely throughout Utah, especially northern Utah. So,
what about clay soils? The garden I have right now is lower end of Hyde Park, so more toward the valley floor, mm-hmm. and there's
plenty of clay.
Yeah,
we find a lot of clay in the valleys, and yeah, in the clay soils, you're going to see an improvement in structure, which will allow for better penetration of water and air and things like that. And you're still going to get the benefit of additional sites for water and nutrient retention. So you're getting benefits on both extremes of soil texture. Sandy soils, you get improvements, and clay soils, you get improvements. And so it's really the very best organic matter is, anyway, the very best soil amendment you can put in there.
What about nutrient value? How does that get affected?
Well, there's a couple of things on nutrient value, depending on the kind of plant you're growing. We talked about nutrient retention. As organic matter decomposes, it provides a lot of sites for the nutrients to adhere to and be stored in soils for later use. But the material itself contains nutrients. It's taking up the nutrients just like any plant would from the soil and storing it in their tissues. And so then it re-releases those back in place. And as it decomposes, it's more of a slow release mechanism. So you can bank on the fact that most of your potassium and phosphorus and things like that that's needed, you know, will remain in the soil over time if you continue to cycle with the organic matter. Nitrogen is going to be depleted regardless of what plants are there, except if you're growing a legume in the system where it's fixing some nitrogen. You'll get a little benefit from that. But typically, we're still going to have to amend with some other supplemental source for nitrogen just because of its dynamic nature and its loss from the system in other ways.
So unless I'm growing a whole field of or a whole garden full of beans or peas or lima beans or anything in that family, I'm going to – and I'm probably going to need to be adding nitrogen anyway.
Right.
But I notice like with my corn – heavy feeder of nitrogen, and I really have to keep putting that back in. So a cover crop of, as much as I don't want to put it in, like maybe a hairy vetch, just because I want to stay on top of it, would be quite beneficial if I'm growing a lot of corn.
If you're growing a lot of corn. And one of the things we find with the cover crops, unless we're growing a legume throughout the course of the summer season, which we typically don't, we'll, you know, plant it and we'll, you know, kill it back before we plant our garden, we won't get the full benefit of the nitrogen fixation even with a legume, but you will get some, and you certainly don't over deplete with respect to nitrogen in a cover crop situation like that with a legume. So it's a really good thing to think if you've got a really heavy feeder, the potatoes and the onions and the corn and things that are really heavy nitrogen feeders, consider maybe using a legume cover crop in the off season.
Well, we have our first caller. We have Tom in Logan. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hey, Brian. I'm doing great. Long time no talk.
Thanks for the call.
Hey, listen, I don't want to get ahead of you guys, but this cover crop thing, I heard that you were going to be talking about that, and I've been fascinated with that, and I really want to try it this fall. I'm wondering a couple of things. You were just talking about the legumes. Is it worthwhile to do that for the nitrogen fix, or would we be better getting just kind of a humus buildup with a maybe a grassier type ground cover? And could you give me like three different types of plant material that we would use that particularly will die out, say, after a fall planting through the winter, so we don't get an invasive kind of a weedy situation?
Yeah, see, Tom knows right where I'm going.
Right
with
where
this.
We're going. Yeah.
I tend to. It's one thing to put in one of these really more aggressive ones that are just great, but if you leave it, it'll go all over the place. So,
vetch comes to mind in that particular context.
Yeah.
Yeah, vetch is a good one, and you know they're these winter annuals that we keep bringing up. The vetch, Austrian winter pea is another common one that we use actually on some of our barley and wheat nurseries in rotation here. You know, in the breeding programs and things like that. The grasses would be like a winter wheat, even, or a winter rye, if you're looking at a grass crop. So those winter annuals are nice in the sense that, you know, once they overwinter and you let them get going in the spring, and they provide the organic matter and the, whatever nutrient cycling and retention that you're going to want. Once you kill them out, they're not going to come back. If you kill them out before they've gone to seed, they won't return as a weed problem. Some of the perennials, we would be concerned with, you know, letting them go into cycles that will allow them to remain persistent in the garden to become a weed problem. But these winter annuals or even the summer annuals, obviously we're past the time when you would be planting the spring-planted summer annuals. But the winter annuals, you know, once you knock them back, if you knock them back before they go to seed, then they won't become a weed problem. They won't be overly aggressive in your garden.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure, go ahead.
I've read about that Austrian pea, and that one kind of fascinated me just because it's pretty bulky, and you get the nitrogen fix out of that. Where does one get the seed for that?
That's a good question. That was another one of the things we kind of previewed maybe talking about. But there's a number of nurseries around that can readily order it if they don't have it in stock. I know that most seed catalogs and things like that you get. I did a quick search just before we got started here on the internet and came up with about, you know, five or six different hits. If you put in Austrian winter pea price or something like that on a Google search, you'll pick up a lot of seed companies that have it available.
Okay.
So, you know, a few places in town, just to mention them, not to sponsor them, but Anderson,
of course,
and some of the other, pretty common nurseries that people go through. They have a variety of seed on hand, and they definitely know where they can go to get it ordered either for you or help you order it yourself. So.
But you like that? You like that Austrian pea?
I do. I've actually used it in my garden a couple of different times, and you know, it gets going long before you can get into the garden because it's too wet and muddy to do anything, and it's growing. There's a couple of advantages there with a crop like that. It's overwintered. It's ready to go. It bolts early in the spring, and it shades the surface of the soil. So some of those early, what would have been, your early spring weeds are shaded out. They're out-competed sometimes. You have a much lower weed pressure going into the spring after you've killed that cover crop out. So you get a couple of advantages, not only with the organic matter and things like that you'll build in your soil, nutrient retention and so forth, but you also get some extra competition against the weeds that'll become
your troubles. You're speaking my language.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's all I wanted to ask. Now, is that a fall-planted crop?
It is, and you'll want to get it in as soon as the garden's out here, so it gives it about, you know, anywhere from 30 to 35, 40 days to get going before we get really heavy frost.
So you're talking by mid-September?
Yeah, mid to late September is when we want to.
I've got a couple of fallow plots that I could do that with.
You could do it now.
I just want to experiment with this darn thing.
You could do those now, and they'd be up and plenty going by the time we hit frost period. So.
What do you like, Brian?
What do I like?
Yeah, what have you used?
I've done buckwheat before, and then I've done oats that actually survived the winter when we didn't have a really heavy winter, and they came back up got going again in the spring.
All right.
I tend to like the more grassy ones because I just know how lazy I am, and they're a little easier to work with. But I've been wanting to do something a little bit heavier.
Yeah. Well, listen, guys, thanks so much. I got to get busy here. I do appreciate it, and keep up the good work, okay?
Thanks, Tom.
See ya.
Take care. If you'd like to join our conversation, Grant Cardin, USU Extension Soil Specialist, is the guest here on Access Utah. For the next 10 minutes, call 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can tweet us your question at hashtag AUGarden. You can also send us an email at upraccess@gmail.com. All right, so realistically, if I'm wanting to get a fall crop established, it could be any time from now until mid to late September in northern Utah.
In northern Utah, and pretty much the same anywhere else. I mean, we have, you know, our average frost dates across the state are in mid to late September. The really heavy frosts don't come until obviously later in the winter. So a killing frost on something like a winter annual is generally delayed reasonably well enough to be able to get a crop in at, you know, mid to late September at the latest and give it time to get up and get going.
So if I usually throw all the leaves from my trees and the neighbor's trees into my garden, I'm probably not going to want to do that, at least in any area that I'm going to plant
the
winter.
Yeah, it might be a little overwhelming to the system at first when it's going along. But, yeah, you're going to be wanting to make sure that there's adequate nutrients. I mean, these are going to need nutrients to establish and so forth. They're not going to be wanting a depleted system to get going. But the nice thing is they'll take those nutrients up, they'll store them in the tissues, and they'll be re-released back. As that decomposes back in the, and more if you're using a legume crop. So it's important to make sure that you're providing an environment for these cover crops to establish as comfortable as you would for your garden plants and things like that you're putting in. They need adequate moisture and adequate nutrients and things to get established and grow well, but they'll take those up and return them back as you incorporate that crop later on.
So something like an Austrian pea, what's that going to look like? Just like a regular
looks
pea.
Looks very similar to a pea. You'll identify it really quickly. It's a little finer stemmed than you say a spring pea type that we use in our gardens. But it'll get up. The times I've used it in the garden, it's gotten up to about a foot to 15 inches or so by late April, and then I'll mow it down and let it dry down a little bit, and then till that back in, and I'm ready to go in mid to late May with it.
Is this the pea that I've seen growing in some of the fields along 800 East?
Yes, yeah, yeah. You'll identify it quickly. It looks like a pea. Yeah,
it comes up really early, yeah. That's for sure.
I know that Dave Hole and his folks out there with those nurseries like to use that in rotation to help protect the soil surface and store some nitrogen and things like that in fallow rotation.
Yeah. Have they seen a difference?
I think they really like that. I know that they've had good success with keeping those fields productive, so it's been a good thing for them, I think.
Now, how do you go about planting it? Is this something that you just kind of use a broadcast spreader and then kind of rake it in, or
the pea needs a little bit more incorporation than say a grass would? A grass you can broadcast it, scratch it in, and it'll do just fine. The pea needs to have some good seed soil contact, so it needs to be down below the surface. You're looking at planting that anywhere from a quarter to a half an inch deep. I've used one of these little corn planter, has a little furrow maker and a disc that, has a seed plate in it. And I've seeded mine about every 5-6 inches between rows, just really dense across the surface of the soil.
And how far apart do you put your rows?
That's what I'm saying. You're talking about, spacing is 2-3 inches between plants
and
about 5-6 inches between
rows.
And I just really kind of densely cover my area. But you'll look out at the fields on 8th East, and they're anywhere from 7 to 10 inches apart, the rows.
And it looks like they're a lot closer together by the way it fills in.
Right. So. The canopy will fill in good. But, yeah, it's, they're just like any other plant. You got to give them a good environment to get going. And if you do, they'll go gangbusters in your garden, and then you'll be able to use that back again as you return it to the soil.
So they need they'll come up, and in the fall when it's fairly cool, they'll come up pretty quick. They'll get established, and then the snow hits hopefully, and they cover them up, and then do they just start growing again?
Yeah, they'll go dormant, and they'll sit in kind of a rosette kind of form. They won't really get really big in the fall. Some of the grasses may get a little bit more growth on them than the pea will, but then it'll really get going as soon as the springtime, the snow melts off. And they'll be going really well long before you can get in and really put anything in because you're worried about soil temperatures and additional frosts early on. These plants will handle those conditions really well.
Now, how easy is it to incorporate that organic matter back into the soil? My peas that I grew here in the spring for eating, I put them back in about the first week of July, and I've got peas growing again coming up in between the rows.
You had some volunteer there.
Yeah, there were some volunteers there. But it seemed fairly easy to incorporate that right back into the soil. And
the Austrian winter pea is, like I said, even finer stemmed and smaller leaf than the spring peas that we put in the garden. So it actually will, it'll be easier to manage. I like to mow it down real close to the ground, about a week before I'm going to incorporate it. It'll dry down on the surface, and it'll be real easy to till back in. So at that point, the root systems begin to die back. The surface materials dry down enough that it incorporates pretty well. And, you know, if you spend a little time with it, you can get it back in the ground pretty easily.
And as far as the ones that are more grassy, any one that stands out for you that you would suggest that can be planted in the fall?
Well, we mentioned a couple of the winter annual grasses, like the winter rye and the winter wheat. Those two are pretty hardy around here that you can use for grass crops. The other ones, most of the grasses, you know, that we might use with some of the spring grains and things like that, we'd want to have those earlier in the season. So you want to have a winter annual, and both winter wheat, winter rye are really well suited to our area.
And the seeds are fairly easy
and
to
very easy to come
to,
about
to come yeah. about, mm-hmm. and really, it's also fairly inexpensive, especially when you look at what you're getting in the long run as far as the health of your soil.
Yeah, the grasses will be probably a little less expensive than the pea. The pea, I was just actually searching real quick here, and we were looking at about $50 for a 50-pound bag. So we're talking about $1 a pound or so. And if you're looking at 2 to 4 pounds per 1,000 square feet in a garden, it's not too expensive to I mean, if you mentioned you had a garden that was some 10,000
yeah,
square feet.
Yeah, it's pretty good size.
Pretty good size garden.
And that's including ornamentals. The yeah. The vegetable garden itself is probably about 6,000.
Yeah, so at 6,000 at 2 to 4 pounds, you're looking at maybe 12 pounds of seed and at $1 a pound. That's it's not very expensive for the benefit you'll get in the long run.
How long can I keep the seed? For instance, if I store it in a cool, dry place, how long will osteo
yeah, I, stay? I'd go a couple of 3 years tops on it. I mean, your germination percentage begins to go down yeah. pretty rapidly after that.
Seems so, like the smaller the seed also, the less likely
the less
it is.
Likely, because it just doesn't have the stores in the embryo over the long term. But the peas, actually, you know, 2 to 3 years of storage, you can use, you know, you can get enough seed to last you for a little while.
So if you're putting in, whether it's a grass-type seed or a pea, you've got to treat these just like you're planting a vegetable garden. They still have to be watered in. They still have to have the nutrients to grow. So how important, how often should you water, for instance?
Well, in the fall, if you've watered it up, you typically don't need to worry about it. Our winter precipitation will keep these generally wet enough, unless we have a really dry winter and the snow doesn't stay out there very much. You might want to, you know, irrigate them, especially some of the drier areas in the state. You know, a single or maybe one or two wintertime irrigations.
Like maybe out in Delta where
yeah,
you don't get a lot of
don't get a lot of freeze, frozen soils and a lot of snowpack and things like that. But
to get established,
the nice
how
thing
often
is,
would you need to water?
Oh, just once. If they're irrigated up and have enough moisture in the soil to get going, they'll be fine at
okay.
that point. Yeah. So, you know, these go dormant. They don't use a lot of water. You just don't necessarily want the root zone to dry out and desiccate out to the point where it doesn't survive the wintertime. So,
now, which cover crops should you be vigilant about making sure that you mow down and turn in the spring?
Well,
maybe not so much with the Austrian winter pea, but you know the vetches. What other ones?
The vetches, the anything that would be a perennial in nature, you want to make sure you've killed it thoroughly and don't leave any of the other material there to continue to grow over time and become a persistent weed. But, you know, in a garden area, we're pretty vigilant about weeding and controlling things. And so unless you're talking about large-scale areas, you'll probably be able to keep up with most of what you would use for a cover crop. It's the real key there is just to make sure that you get it before it goes to seed or if it goes into any vegetatively propagated kind of, you know, additional daughter plant or something like that that'll continue on there. So then there's not many of those that we would use as cover crops anyway. So
what about in the spring? If you decided you wanted to wait and do something in the spring, what time should you plant? I guess it depends on if it's it's cool.
Yeah,
hardy plant.
Most of our spring grains and the oats, like you talked about, and some of those grass crops, even some of the peas, we can use the pea. Not the winter pea, but a spring pea in the early season, you know, come springtime. So as soon as you can get in and work the soil on some of those, you can typically get those in. Pay attention, and it'll tell you what on any given plant that you choose, it'll tell you what would be the optimal soil temperatures to consider, you know, before you actually put it in the ground.
So as a soil specialist, if you had your choice, what do you prefer? Do you prefer the legumes so you can have that nitrogen-fixing capability?
you know, up here in northern Utah, you never know whether you're going to be able to get out there in the early spring to do anything. It's going to be too wet.
This spring was great. Yeah, the last few springs, not so much. Yeah.
So I'm more inclined to go with a fall or winter annual so that I can get it in after my garden's done. I'm already doing the gardening anyway. I'm kind of in that routine of being out there and working with the area. So get that cover crop in and let it overwinter, and then come what may, basically in the spring, it's in there and it's growing, and you know, that headache's out of your way, and you'll get the benefit come when you really can get out there and do something by knocking it back and getting it in the ground.
And I'm imagining it probably would be best if you're like me and you do like to get out there and get your regular peas planted by the 17th of March, you know, as soon as the ground is open, basically. Then you just leave a little area open that you put in your really early crops, like your seeded onions and your leaf lettuces and spinach and so forth, and then just have this other area that it's coming up, and then you can just till it in.
You can till it in, yep. That would work too. Or, you know, it doesn't take much to kill these back. So if it may not be growing great in an area, but you could plant the whole area and just go right back into your spring planted areas.
And how well do these do at lightening the soil? I know for me, if it can take a lot to get my garden dried out in the spring.
Yeah, these will use water and early on in the springtime, so it'll help draw that down a little more, and it'll dry out a little bit faster than it will in typical, you know, just open fallow conditions. So. Yeah, it gives you that a little bit extra benefit of getting in there a little bit sooner too. Sometimes, as it's helped pull some of that moisture out of the system.
Can you use these in if you don't have a large garden? Can you use them in small gardens or in raised beds?
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing that restricts them there. You're wanting to keep those thriving in terms of organic matter content and you know, nutrient retention and water retention too, and you're replenishing that in those systems just as well as you would elsewhere. And you know, it's I like seeing this you know, little cover crop and things are growing out there, and it's it appeals to the gardener in an individual to see something actively growing and knowing you're getting the benefit that you are from it.
I know when I had the oats over winter, it was great to look out in the garden in that early spring and see green coming up and knowing that they weren't weeds.
That you weren't going, oh, good grief, what a spring I've got involved, yeah, for me. But
well, the time's gone real quick. Thanks for coming in to talk about this.
And we can talk about it some other time too, more if we get a little chance. But
great. Yeah. You've been listening to Access Utah. This first half hour, we've had Grant Cardin, USU Extension Soil Specialist. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to talk about food preservation with Teresa Hunsaker from the Weber County Extension Office. Right now is the latest edition of Wild About Utah, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Holly Strand. Beavers and beaver dams are a common feature of the Utah landscape. You'll see the dams on low-gradient streams, fashioned from branches, down trees, and mud. The still deep water of the resulting pond creates ideal conditions for a beaver lodge. Beavers can escape and hide from predators by slipping into the pond and disappearing into the lodge. Beavers also use their ponds to cache their favorite food, aspen and willow. Because of their tree-cutting and dam-making skills, humans tend to have two divergent opinions of beavers, a 60-pound nuisance or an environmental engineer. Beavers are considered a nuisance when they gnaw down trees that humans want to keep. Dams can flood roads or stop up irrigation canals. Whenever beaver activity conflicts with human interests, they, the beavers, are likely to be trapped and killed. On the other hand, beaver activity has many positive environmental consequences that we are just beginning to appreciate. Wetlands created by beaver dams help soak up sediments, improving downstream water quality. Because of beaver dams, the winter snowpack isn't lost in a short spring pulse. This results in a more constant stream flow through the summer, and that's important as Utah's climate is predicted to become drier. Finally, Beaver dams enhance habitat for many other fish and wildlife species and plants. According to Dr. Joe Wheaton, geomorphologist at Utah State University, there's a lot of untapped potential for beaver engineering. Say you want to create a wetland. You need to excavate channels, redirect stream flow, revegetate, and nurture the area for a long period of time. To accomplish this, you'll need a number of highly trained professionals and some large Tonka trucks. Alternatively, under the right conditions, you might transplant a colony of beavers and let them apply their vigorous work ethic to your landscape and get quite satisfying results. Recognizing that nuisance beavers can be rehabilitated into hardworking wetland engineers and habitat restorationists, the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources has rolled out the state's first beaver management plan. This plan encourages live trapping of entire families of beavers and moves them to specific sites where their environmental services can be appreciated and put to use. For Wild About Utah, I'm Holly Strand.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Hello, welcome back to the second part of Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me on the line from Weber County is Teresa Hunsaker. She's with the Weber County Extension Office, and we're going to talk food preservation and would invite your questions or comments. Teresa, thanks for joining me on the program.
You bet. Happy to be here.
If you'd like to talk to us about food preservation, call us at 1-800-826-1495. You can tweet us your question at #AUGarden or email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com. Now, Teresa, I was in my garden this last week, and boy, the beans are sure coming on quite a bit. So I know what we're going to be revving up to do, because we typically will process anywhere from 60 to 75 quarts of beans to tide us over until next year.
You bet.
What have you got a class that's coming up, or was it just held?
Just held last Saturday.
Okay,
yeah.
So how did that go?
Justin Edwards. Great. Very good. We've had a number of canning classes and lots of requests, typically this time of year because of people's produce and gardens and that type of thing. So, yeah, across the state, we're in full gear with canning and classes and questions on the phone.
Okay, well, let's start out right at the very beginning. There are a couple of types, a couple of ways to can as far as the lids are concerned. Just last year, we bought these plastic lids. I don't even remember the name of the company. But
Battler.
Yes, and you can use them over and over again, and so far they seem to work.
Yeah. Let me tell you about that. USDA and USU, under the umbrella of USDA, has not completed the research on that, and so we don't have a position paper. I know that the testing through the company suggests that they're okay to use, but we are concerned. And so right now we're just recommending that people use them for high-acid foods, their peaches, their jams, their jellies, their fruit juices, you know, that kind of thing, until we can finish up some further research as to how well those keep sealing and getting a good, strong pounds per square inch seal. So.
And so
yes, they're out there.
So you're doing some research right now?
Uh-huh.
Oh, great. So, yeah, one thing I would be concerned also about is how long do these last? Is it really as long as the company is saying? I mean, I look at the rings that go with the lids, and I think, okay, is this really this rubber, how long is that going to last? Because they're fairly expensive to
yes,
purchase
they
up front.
Are. Yeah, you'll pay three times as much, but that's the whole idea is they are – they're supposed to be designed for reuse and storage in between use. And so what makes that better, and why aren't the other agencies and organizations, you know, companies coming up with this fantastic sealing compound that can be used over and over again, right? And so there is a question out there. And we are, like I said, issuing kind of a caution in using them for high acid foods, water bath foods only.
So the name of the company is what Tattler, again?
Tattler, T-A-T-T-L-E-R.
And only, if for right now, you're recommending only to use them for the high acid foods.
Right. But they are nice. I bought some. I've used some. I've done them on my pickles and used them on my apricot nectar and, you know, that kind of thing already this season. I just am not going to use them in my pressure canner until I get a little more information.
Okay, and that sounds like wise advice. All right, so with your class, if you are a beginning food preservationist, where do you start? I mean, there's so much to be involved in, from, you know, what kind of water canner do you get? What type of bottles? Do you do wide mouth? Do you do narrow? How do you decide how to even start? What resources do you have?
Oh, that is a great question. And one of the very first things that I would encourage people to do that are just getting started is to do some research and some reading. Just like we do on any other kind of hobby or activity, we need to lay the foundation with some knowledge. And so I would suggest that people go online to the National Center for Home Food Preservation. It's www.nchfp.uga.edu. National Center for Home Food Preservation can also just be typed into your search engine. They are fantastic at tutorials, at recipes, at methods, procedures, altitude adjustments. They have information on supplies. Yes, you asked about the jars. We want you to use standard canning jars. Whether you choose wide mouth or regular, that's kind of a personal preference. I find myself going more to the wide mouth for things that have to be stacked or layered or that aren't liquid, like my salsa or nectar and things like that. I use my regular bottles for, but for things that are in chunks or large pieces or stacked, I use my wide mouth. It just makes it easier to get them in. Make sure that the bottles that they're getting are don't have any cracks or things like that across the, you know, top of it.
So you're looking to see if, make sure there's not any chips, especially
exactly.
If you've gotten your bottles at the local DI or something.
Exactly, because they are passed along. And I would get the standard canning lids as well, the standard rings, the standard lids, and not some off-brand that, you know, we don't know about. Another thing, too, I would start with water bath. So that can be anything that's high acid. That would be my fruit juice, my jams, my jellies. Everything now has a water bath time at minimum. Obviously, the low-acid foods are going to be pressure canned. But nothing has an open kettle. Like, I just don't boil my jam and then pour it into the bottles and expect it to self-seal. We want a processing time added to that. So the next thing that I would recommend for somebody getting started is to ignore what Grandma taught us. Not that in this particular case it's all bad, but we want you to, like I said, start with the good new information first and make sure that the methods and the procedures and the times for altitudes and everything are just right on the money so that you're not discouraged with having wasted.
Don't can pearl barley. I'll just tell you that right now.
Brian, I love it. You're right. Did you learn from sad experiences?
No. I've had the opportunity of interviewing food preservationists, and Christine Saunders told me a long time ago, don't do pearl barley. And then she told me all the horror stories. So that just kept me right away from that.
True story, I know.
Okay, so let's talk about what are the things that you should not can, or especially if you're a beginner. What things should you stay away from? You mentioned the lower acid foods.
Right. With a water bath, I can only do the high acid foods. So I cannot, with a water bath, do green beans. We've just addressed that they're coming off. I could not do any winter squash, such as pumpkin cubes or, you know, something like that. I cannot do any dry beans, such as pinto or black beans. I can't do any meat. With a water bath canner, all of those require a pressure canner. And the thing that we're wanting to guard against is this deadly toxin from the botulism spore. And that spore loves anaerobic, which is what I've got in a sealed bottle, so a no-air anaerobic condition, and it also loves no acid or low acid. So we have to guard against that by killing that spore outright so it can't produce its toxin. And that's why I, as a beginner canner, I just encourage you to start with some real simple things that go together quickly, that are easy to do, that create a high success rate for you and make you feel good about what you've done and the time that you've spent. And then as time goes on, get more familiar with the whole preservation process and move then on to the pressure canner. Because quite frankly, I love my pressure canner. I love it for the convenience of having foods on hand to be able to put a meal together. I've got my beef cubes. I've got my potatoes, onions, and celery all bottled. I've got, you know what I mean?
So we really use a pressure canner all the time.
And what's that?
We use a pressure canner all the time. Just
yeah.
A smaller one. We did all our corn in pressure canner. I just say no to boiled corn. Because pressure canner, it just tastes better. It just better texture in the mouth. And it's so easy to throw things together.
Yeah, it really, that's, again, see, that's what I say. So, and when we're talking those kinds of foods, it rounds out a really nice food storage program to have the skill and the comfort level of using the pressure canner. But again, I probably wouldn't start with that.
Okay, so I'm just wondering if you've got grandma's recipes for food canning, throw those out because they're not tested.
Right. And grandma will argue that, yes, they are tested because I've been doing it that way for years and
yeah.
I haven't killed anybody yet. But
all
we
it takes
want
is one person.
Through USDA, through food scientists, and the whole realm of optimum food safety. And that's what we're going to give you when you call any of our extension offices during canning season. We're going to give you optimum, no risk, food safety for food preservation. And those are out of USDA. Those are out of the National Center for Home Food Preservation. They are out of the current Ball books. You can get these information sources so readily through the Extension, through their websites, and through the Ball Corporation. Right now, their books are everywhere.
I was going to say, so Ball and Kerr are both producing their books?
Uh-huh. Ball is. Kerr has kind of merged with Ball, and
oh, that's
you won't
not good.
Find current Kerr canning books.
Okay, that's kind of another one of my pet peeves. I've noticed that there's not a lot of selection. You don't, not like there used to be, even 10, 15 years ago. Everyone's combining with each other, and I keep seeing the prices on stuff kind of going through the roof. I'm like, I'm paying this much for 12 bottles of glass?
Right.
So, so is it still okay if I find used products as long, like the jars, for instance, as long as I'm finding them in good condition, they're still usable?
Yes, I would definitely go that route. Obviously, we need to use new lids.
Mm-hmm.
I can use old rings, but I do need to use the new lids. But as far as water bath canners, I can get those at yard sales. I can, and you just want to look for ones that are in good condition, like you've already said. And yeah, it's an initial outlay, but so is any sport, hobby, activity. There's an initial outlay, and I'm not going to suggest that it is inexpensive when I consider my time. What I am going to suggest is that there's benefits in quality, flavor. I know what's going into the bottles in selection of the produce that I am putting up. I get to control the salt, the sugar, all, you know, those kinds of things that then make it a real nice skill to have on hand, especially when I've got these bumper crops of produce, whether because my neighbors are dropping it all off on my doorstep or because I've got a garden that is doing really well. So I know it can be discouraging initially, but again, you can find good, safe product supplies for canning to keep the cost down.
Well, and once you get going, as you mentioned, you have the supplies right there, and all you have to worry about usually are the lids.
Yep, exactly. And that's the main thing, and those are pretty inexpensive right now when you buy things on, canning season.
Can you find that sort of thing in bulk online at a better price?
Yeah, you can. You can find them a number of places. You can even find some of the canning books that are still up to date through Amazon. You can find things through Craigslist, through KSL, through a number of places like that have lightly, slightly used items, certainly through your discount store such as DI, Salvation Army, that type of thing. You'll find the bottles, the canners, and those locations as well.
I know. I do love the county extension offices for all of the information that they have there, because it'll either be no cost or very low cost. And that's where I've picked up most of my the recipes that we've used, that our ball book and our Kerr book from, I hope they're still up to date, from 10 years ago.
Right.
They've got plenty of scribblings in them. There are food stains, of course, within them, but there are a ton of recipes.
And that's the thing, too. You know, with the internet now, and yeah, I can get a lot of sources that I don't necessarily want, but boy, I can also access the National Center for Home Food Preservation 24/7. And sometimes that's when we're canning, is at 2 in the morning, because it's cooler in our kitchen, mm-hmm. and, you know, we finally got around to it. But quite frankly, I can access that internet source for a myriad of recipes, and they've got some amazing combinations now. They've got a number of salsas, which is the number one thing that we in Utah bottle, and they've got a variety of recipes for salsa that are just yummy. And so I can find just about anything from a peach salsa to a pineapple salsa to a tomatilla salsa, and that makes it so nice, because I can then access that, you know, in the confines of my own home and get busy and get something done. They've even got things like a home-bottled, safe-for-shelf-life lemon curd. And I have made that, bottled that, and given that as gifts. And honestly, it is divine. So, yeah, check out those good, recent Ball and USDA canning guides that are in print. But certainly we can go to the National Center for up-to-date information, too.
Now, how much, if any, experimentation should you do on recipes? I would imagine leave the quantity of the food as well as the time that it has to be canned alone. I mean, that part's
right.
Been tested. You can experiment with some of the spices, maybe?
You can, and that would be the one word of caution that I would give, is don't mess around, especially like on a salsa recipe or a mixture of product. You know, don't mess around with that. We've formulated that exactly for pH, and that's one of the things that we want to make sure that we're keeping in check when we're water bathing, is the pH of the food, the acidity of the food. So the spices I can adjust. If I don't like oregano in my tomatilla salsa recipe that I come across, and I'm not a fan of oregano, then I can leave that out, or I can put in Italian seasoning if that were, you know, something I wanted to do. It's the spices that I've got some flexibility with, but I don't with the vegetable fruit combinations, the pickling options for. I get a lot of questions at the extension office. Oh, I don't like it so vinegary on my pickles. Can I just back off the vinegar and add water? Well, no, because then that's changing the acidity. Those are the kinds of questions we want people to call in and ask us in their county extension offices.
And then as far as the different equipment, it seemed like steam canners were the big thing 20 years ago. I don't see them as much.
You know, there was some confusion with the steam canners, because steam is actually hotter than boiling water. And so USDA said, you know, people aren't making their own altitude adjustments appropriately. And to throw a third time chart out there for steam canners, and there were so many just subsequent problems with the steam canner. We had more buckling. We had of the lids, you know, the little tucks that those lids get in them. We had more siphoning. People were not happy because they'd get so much liquid loss through siphoning. We would have a softer fruit, and so people weren't happy. They'd get more bottle breakage. And so finally, USDA just said, you know what, we're just not going to encourage the use of the steam canner. There's too many variables that are causing problems. And so while they are still being used and you can still purchase them, I would encourage people to use them for low processing times on high acid foods, such as my juice, my jams, my jellies, that kind of thing.
So things without too many solids in them, so that
so
that the heat can get all the way through the product.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I wouldn't use it for my salsa or my whole tomatoes, you know, that type of thing. I just, there's just too many variables that people have been unhappy with, and USDA just finally said there's too many concerns.
So you mentioned siphoning. That's like one of the perennial problems. How do you keep the water from coming out of those jars? Some of the tomatoes that we've done. It's
like, 2 inches down.
Yeah,
the
there's
bottom.
2 inches left. So what's the key for that?
The key for siphoning is to get air bubbles out, allow enough headspace, have the water in your water bath canner at a low boil, not this ridiculous raucous boil that spurts all over the stove, and then the last few minutes of the processing time, turn the heat down, not off, but turn it down to just a very low or warm so that you're still breaking the surface with boiling bubbles. Take the lid off, and one of the things that I do...
The band? Take the band off?
The lid of the water bath canner.
Oh, the canner. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. No, don't adjust any of that. And then I kind of temper the bottles by using my jar lifter and taking the bottles up partway out of the water and then setting them back down into the water and up partway, and I just hold them for a couple of seconds. I mean, think about this, Brian. If I were to take a 110-degree day or 105-degree day and throw myself into a pool that's loaded with ice, I've got that same temperature variable. I'm going to suck air when I hit that ice water, aren't I?
Yeah.
So that's what our bottles are doing. So I need to break them in to their new environment, this cooler kitchen. And even though it may be steaming hot to us in there while we're canning, it isn't to a bottle, coming out of that boiling water bath. So temper it. Allow it to adjust by backing off the heat, taking the lid off the canner, bringing the jars up, and then setting them back down just that last minute of the processing time. And you will be so much happier with, and so will they, the bottles.
Well,
you just won't get the siphoning.
That's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to get started with their beans. Teresa, we've reached the end of our time. I could use you for a couple of hours at least, so we'll do this again.
Me.
Thanks, Teresa.
Uh-huh.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Teresa Hunsaker is from the Weber County Extension Office, and she's been our guest for the second half of the program. I wanted to mention that on July 26th, Mountain Valley Seeds is having a greenhouse class and how they can be used. Cost is $10. Information is the 801-486-0480. And USU Extension is offering a class on August 30th from 2 to 4 in the afternoon that will also teach you about tunnel greenhouses. Information is at 801-451-3411. Thanks for joining us on Access Utah.
Create a new plant from your favorite heirloom vine or shrub with layering. Try this method on raspberries, climbing roses, forsythia, and jasmine. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Select a long, pliable stem. Make a notch halfway through the stem and about 9 to 12 inches below the end of the stem. Sprinkle a rooting hormone over the cut area to ward off rot and speed rooting. Bury the notch portion of the stem in the surrounding garden soil or a pot filled with a well-drained potting mix. Leave the top 6 to 9 inches of the stem above ground. Anchor the stem with a stone or wire wicket to keep the notch portion covered with soil. Keep the soil moist to encourage rooting. The parent plant will continue to provide water and nutrients to this stem as the roots develop. In several months, you can disconnect the newly rooted plant from its parent. Plant and provide proper care. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
This is KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.